الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر
Beneficent, the merciful, the creator and the sustainer of the universe, peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I greet you with a greeting that is common in Islam, a greeting of peace. Assalamu alaikum. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. Today we have our seventh program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam, and we'll be continuing with our third program in discussing the topic of production and productivity. Joining me, as usual, on the program is Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Could I have you very quickly summarize the main points that we touched on in our second program dealing with the topic of production and productivity?
Sure. The major part of the discussion was on the position of Islam vis-a-vis science and how it encouraged the use of the senses, reason, and experimentation. We indicated that the experimental approach or scientific approach was not really introduced to the West by Roger Bacon as usually held, but that approach was known to Muslims centuries before that and used it effectively. Indicated also that the scientific progress that was achieved started all the way from the revelation of the Quran itself during the first four caliphs after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, called the Al-Khulafa al-Rashidun, or the four lightly guided caliphs, continued through the Umayyad dynasty, but had its golden age, if you will, during the Abbasid dynasty, and also the Amawi dynasty in Spain. It was also indicated that there were several centers for education and scientific progress on different levels, all the way from schools attached to local mosques or places of worship, to city libraries, to big academies like the famous House of Learning in Baghdad, established in the 9th century. So the main problem here, or the main issue, was that the European Renaissance was not really based, as some people believed, in simply revival of the Greek classic, but it was very much influenced by the Muslim science and development at this time, and that the connection is really very, very close.
I'd like to pick up on that point, the connection between the European Renaissance and Muslim or Islamic science, and I wonder if perhaps I could ask you to, we just had time last week to touch on that, I wonder if I could have you perhaps expand on it a little bit further.
Certainly. In fact, one of the very astounding and very useful references on this subject is a book by Georges Sartre. It's called Intellectual or History of Intellectual Development. Sorry, Introduction to the History of Sciences. It's a very comprehensive work composed of several volumes. And he indicates in that one of the main reasons why universities sprang in Europe was the fact that there were so much Muslim sciences and information coming from the Muslim world,
yes,
that it came to a point where the mass of this information required some kind of systematic study. So that's why universities were established in Europe. And he says that goes back as far as the 12th century and even before, because the 12th century universities began to emerge in Europe. So the contact and the adoption of Muslim learning took place before that time also. Let me give you a couple of quotations also from another writer we quoted last time, Robert Bifold, in his book The Making of Humanity. In one he says that it is highly probable that but for the Arabs, he means the Muslims, modern European civilization would never have arisen at all. In another place he says that there is no single aspect of European growth in which decisive influence of Islamic culture is not traceable. Also, what we call science arose in Europe as a result of a new spirit of inquiry, a new method of investigation, of the methods of experimentation, observation, measurement, of the development of mathematics in a form unknown to the Greeks. That spirit and those methods were introduced into the European world by the Arabs. I just have a comment here on the use of the term Arabs.
Yes.
You know, I don't think it's quite correct to interpret that in an ethnic sense at all. And many of the writers, when they refer to the Arabs, actually they use it synonymous with Muslims, which is not a very accurate term. Unless we take it, of course, in the spirit expressed by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that any person who speaks Arabic is an Arab, it's not just ethnic lines. And of course, in the epoch of Muslim civilization, every Muslim, regardless of his or her mother tongue, also knew Arabic, being the language of civilization, the language of scripture, the language of science. So it can be only accepted in that sense. But I prefer the word Muslim, though.
Yes. Well, I'd like to perhaps turn to some discussion of the Crusades. Did they play any role in the European Renaissance?
Well, while, of course, the tragic part of the Crusades is well known, the kind of devastation it brought to the Muslim world, it still appears that there are some side effects, just like any other war. Sometimes you get unintended results from it. That it contributed also a great deal, at least in conveying or providing an opportunity for getting the Muslim sciences and knowledge to the West. Let me give you a couple of quotations which has been compiled in a little booklet, just a very small pamphlet under the title Islam and the Origin of Modern Science by Khawaja Abdul Wahid. He compiled a number of those references, so maybe I can just save time by referring to some of them. At one point, Dr. W.B. Stevenson, a historian who wrote a chapter in Volume 4 on the universal history of the world, he says, the learning and art and science of the East, he means Muslim world,
yes,
its public services and methods of government, its highly developed industries, and the superior luxury and comfort of the domestic life in its upper classes, exerted a powerful and far-reaching influence upon Europe in the crusading period. So there is definitely some points of contact there. Another historian, Henry Barnes, in discussing the consequences of the Crusades, that's in Volume 1 of the History of Western Civilization, he says the Westerners learned many Muslim and Oriental ways and developed a taste for the luxuries of the region. All this promoted a demand for Eastern goods and accelerated the growth of commerce. The Italians, who had acted as transporting agents for the Crusaders, took full advantage of their opportunities to build up trading relations with the East. In another place, he adds, the science and culture of the Muslims were brought back to Europe and helped to create a remarkable intellectual revival, or the remarkable intellectual revival of the 12th and 13th century. Maybe I can give one more from again, the reference I alluded to before, George Sarton, the Introduction to the History of Science. In that also, he says, one of the results of the Crusades was the reintroduction of public bathing places in Europe. And he goes on discussing this notion of steam bath, which was introduced by Muslims, and the Crusaders brought the idea with them back to Europe. I think it would be useful to remember that the period of Crusades were not all two centuries, let's say, of fighting in battlefield. There were periods also of truce, of relative peace, a period where there was some kind of intermingling and mixing between Muslims and Christians, even the invaders, between the invaders and the conquered. There were incidents also where human relations could have been established between the two people. In fact, many historians, for example, refer to places like Sicily in Syria, where there were a great deal of person-to-person intermingling between Muslim scientists and learned scholars and the invading crusaders. And in fact, even in places like Spain, we find that the intermingling included both Muslim Christians as well as Jews, in a way that some historians described as unrestricted, unrestrained type of contact. Definitely the result of that was a great deal of exchange of information, mostly really adaptation of Muslim sciences and bringing it to the West. And in the case of Spain, the result was untold prosperity, which was never precedented before nor surpassed ever since.
Now, some of our viewers may consider that to be a quite strong statement to make. Can you give us perhaps some illustrations to reinforce or illustrate that point?
Well, the issue of Muslim Spain, a civilization of nearly 8th centuries, is something really that is a big topic by itself. I could perhaps, to satisfy curiosity of some of the viewers, refer to one or two references on that. There is a book called The Falcon of Spain, written by a Canadian Muslim, Dr. Thomas Irving. And there is also another famous book on the subject. It's called The Story of... what's the exact title? Story of the Moors in Spain, written by Stanley Lane Poole, P-O-O-L-E.
Yes.
And in this references, as well as others, you find so many fascinating things that it's very difficult to believe, really, that at one point of time this has taken place. Let me read you a couple of quotations from Poole's, Stanley Poole's reference. He says, for nearly 8 centuries, under her Mohammedan, it should be actually Muslim, this is not a proper term, but anyway, that's the term he used, Mohammedan rulers, Spain set to all Europe a shining example of a civilized and enlightened state. Her fertile provinces, rendered doubly prolific by the industry and engineering skill of her conquerors, bore fruit an hundredfold. In another part, he says, art, literature, and science prospered as they then prospered nowhere else in Europe. Students flocked from France and Germany. That's the point, again, we discussed in the previous program, where the only place to get learning about science for Europeans at that time was to go to Muslim universities, more particularly in under Muslim Spain. And England, to drink from the fountain of learning which flowed only in the cities of the Moor. The surgeons and doctors of Andalusia were in the van of science. Women were encouraged to devote themselves to serious study. And the lady doctor was not unknown among the people of Cordova, that's in Spain.
Yes.
Mathematics, astronomy, and botany, history, philosophy, and jurisprudence were to be mastered in Spain and Spain alone. In another place, he says that whatsoever makes a kingdom great and prosperous, whatsoever tends to refinement and civilization, was found in Muslim Spain. And then finally, he mentions about the sorry and sad end of all of this civilization. He says in 1492, the last bulwark of the Moors gave way before the crusade of Ferdinand and Isabella. And with Granada fell all Spain's greatness. This is one. In fact, some of the very fascinating aspects of it is a description provided by John William Draper in the book The Intellectual or History of the Intellectual Development of Europe. In the second volume of that book, pages 30 and 31, just pick a short quotation. Draper describes a city like Cordova.
Yes.
And he says Cordova, under their administration, that's under Muslim administration, at its highest point of prosperity, boasted of more than 200,000 houses and more than a million of inhabitants.
Yes.
After sunset, a man might walk through it in a straight line for 10 miles by the light of the public lamps. 700 years after this time, there was not so much as one public lamp in London. Its streets, that's the streets of Cordova, were solidly paved. In Paris, centuries subsequently, whoever stepped over his threshold on a rainy day stepped up to his ankles in mud. And he indicates also that it was not simply just one exceptional city that was so prosperous,
yes,
like Cordova. He indicates that there are so many other cities in Spain, like Granada, Seville, and Toledo, which consider themselves as rivals even to Cordova. The contributions of the development and prosperity, you know, of Cordova is just untold. In fact, some historians add to these figures, the 1 million inhabitants and the nearly 260,000 buildings, homes and shops, 4,300 markets, 700 public bathing places, 500 mosques, and as we mentioned earlier, it was customary to attach a school, a public school, to the mosque. They can also tell about the number of schools. 28 suburbs. Do you think that suburb is something, you know, that's,
yes,
relatively new? It wasn't in the case of Cordova. In addition to this, there were countless, in the word of one historian, countless libraries, both public as well as private. So the story of the Islamic civilization and prosperity in Spain is just beyond description. You're talking now about population of Cordova, probably not even 1/20th,
yes,
probably, of the population that it one time had with all this civilization and progress.
Extremely interesting case study. Mm-hmm. Well, we've been discussing the contribution of Islamic scientists and Muslim scientists in a general kind of way. I wonder if perhaps we might be able to now turn to some discussion of some specific contributions in the various fields. Perhaps we could do that by going through an alphabetical order. I wonder if I could ask you first of all to give some illustrations of some specific contributions in the field of astronomy.
Well, astronomy by its nature was one of the earliest fields in which Muslims took interest and contributed a great deal. Among the most prominent scholars, if you will, are people like Abu al-Wafa, al-Batani, al-Bayruni, Ulugh Beg, and I'll come in a minute again to indicate more specifically some of their particular contributions. But suffice to say that Muslim astronomers were the first to discover the sun's apogee, which is, you know, the point farthest from the earth,
yes,
in the orbit of the moon. They made catalogues of the stars, not only catalogues, but in fact some of them even made maps of visible stars. And they gave it, especially the big ones, they gave it names, Arabic names, which are still with us until today. They corrected the sun and moon tables.
Mm-hmm.
And they also fixed the length of the year. In fact, as early as the 11th century, Umar al-Khayyam, known in the West as Khayyam, connected mainly with poetry, but in fact he was also a prominent astronomer. In the days of Khayyam, he made a calendar which many historians regard as more accurate than the Gregorian calendar. The Muslim astronomers were the first to use the pendulum,
yes,
in measuring times, and some of those who traveled to the Muslim world came back with a great deal of fascination describing, you know, how their clocks operate using this concept of the pendulum. The sundial was again invented by Muslim astronomers, Ibn Yunus. In fact, as one writer puts it, Draper, he says perhaps the most valuable of all chronometric improvements were made, in fact, by Muslim astronomers. As early as the 8th century, during the Caliphate of Al-Mansur, we find that interest has been shown in astronomy in different parts of the Muslim world, which was quite vast at this time. Mm-hmm. We find also many observatories being built. Muslim astronomers were able to use their knowledge to predict, forecast the sunspots, eclipses, and the appearance of comets in the sky. One of the great names I mentioned earlier, like Abu'l-Wafa, discovered something which is very important in astronomy. Astronomers call it the third lunar inequality, which is basically dealing with the concept of the irregularity of the moon's highest latitude. Mm-hmm. Astronomers definitely appreciate that more than, you know, common person. It is interesting to notice that this very important discovery was attributed by mistake 1,000 years later, almost 10 centuries later.
Yes.
The same kind of discovery was attributed to a Danish scholar by the name of Tycho Brahe. Among the other bright names, I mentioned Al-Battani, and sometimes these names in English really are quite adulterated. In English it's written Al-Battaginas, which is very difficult to detect and relate. Mm-hmm. Was regarded by astronomers as one of the most important 20 astronomers in the world. Yes. Talking past and present, at least up to the time. Al-Biruni acted as a link between the astronomy school in Baghdad, which is now in Iraq, and in India. And he lived in the court of Mahmud Ghaznawi towards the end of the 10th century and the beginning of the 11th century. Actually, he compiled an interesting table showing the longitudes and latitudes of the principal cities in the world. Ulugh Beg work was published in the early 15th century, and in it he provided a very comprehensive survey of the state of knowledge of astronomy in his time, and that was 100 years before Kepler tried to relate the knowledge of astronomy in the past to his time. In Muslim Spain, as we mentioned earlier, it's not just the general prosperity. Prosperity also was hand in hand with the scientific development. We find many bright examples like Ibn Khaldun, Ibn Rushd, in English, Averroes. But unfortunately, many of their deeds, many of their works, were lost in the period of reconquest and the ensuing religious persecution. So much valuable work was also lost to history.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder if we could perhaps move into the field of chemistry next. What role did Muslim science play in developing this particular science?
Well, John William Draper included or clarified, he said that the originators, the Arabs or Muslims, should be regarded really as the originators of scientific chemistry. That's not my word, that's his term. And he said they discovered the most important reagents in chemistry, like sulfuric acid, nitric acid, alcohol. They were the first to publish pharmacopoeia, or dispensatories. One of the great figures in chemistry goes back to the 8th century, known in English as Geber, who lived at the time where the strongest acid known at this time was concentrated vinegar.
Yes.
And it was during his time and through his effort that he discovered the nitric acid. The Muslim chemists were able to describe and prepare or understood the operations of distillation, sublimation, filtration, coagulation, crystallization, something that we think that is relatively more modern. This was already known quite early to Muslim chemists. Another great figure in chemistry by the name of Abu Bakr al-Razi, again in English it's written quite differently.
Yes.
It's written Razes, R-H-A-Z-E-S. He used to be the physician in chief of the hospital in Baghdad in the 9th century. And he was said to be the first one who described the properties of the sulfuric acid. The contribution in his time by Muslims to the study of chemistry was described by William Draper as important in magnitude as those of Lavoisier and Priestley. In addition to this, we find that Muslims were the first to use the gunpowder in defense as early as 1342, and that's quite a period of time before Roger Bacon. Another great chemist, Muslim chemist, who lived towards the end of the 8th century, his name is Abu Musa al-Kufi. He wrote so many works in chemistry, some of which were translated into Latin, and one important work of his called in English, The Sum of Perfection, was translated into French as late as 1672. And that is almost 800 years nearly after his death. This kind of contributions reflect the practical spirit of inquiry that Muslims have learned through the motivation provided in the Quran. They understood not only theoretical chemistry, but they were quite prominent also in the applied side of chemistry. Indeed, suffice to make a point that they have already known that early the distillation or distilled water. They knew of plasters, they knew of syrups, and of course for physicians and pharmacists, they appreciate the more important role played by syrups in the preparation of countless drugs, especially like cough medicines and so on. They were able to use also the varieties of ointments for cure of certain diseases. They knew about dyeing, D-Y-E,
yes.
Dyeing clothing and so on, textile, tempering steel, curing leather, and these are definitely some aspects of applied chemistry in a way that would be useful and beneficial to the populace. The interesting thing to add here also is that many of the terms in English or other European languages of many chemical material substances actually have their names originally from Arabic. This might not sound familiar to many of the viewers, but it's true. Take for example the camphor in English, camphor oil. In Arabic it's kafur. Same thing. Alcohol was, as we indicated early, a Muslim invention, and the English is simply the same term, alcohol. Elixir.
Yes.
In Arabic, elixir.
Yes.
It's the same. The name came from it. Alkali. See, come from kalawi in Arabic. And this is only a few examples of the numerous chemical substances that were discovered and prepared by the Muslim chemists.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll have to stop at that for today because our time is gone. We want to invite you back next week when we'll continue our discussion looking at the contribution of Muslim science to the fields of mathematics, medicine, and physics. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
Allahu Akbar.